Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you, Chris Martin. Sweeping those streets I used to roam. This is Greg Masters, and I am your co-host on This Week in Oncology. And joining me, as always, is my partner and co-conspirator, Dr. Richard Just. Are you there, Rich?
I'm here and raring to go.
Awesome. Well, we got a great program today. I want to tell you a little bit about our guest. We are going to speak with Elizabeth Salata. Dr. Salata graduated from Revell College with a degree in biology, obtained a master's degree in public health nutrition from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and attended medical school at Wake Forest University, where she received honors in family practice in internal medicine. Her final training was obtained from Pennsylvania State University, where she completed her residency in internal medicine, and she's been board certified in internal medicine and practicing in San Diego since 1966.
A little long ago.
Excuse me. 96. Pardon me.
Okay.
I was going to say.
I would love to have that much wisdom, but.
That would be the origins of the Medicare program. I don't think that we'll go that far. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you anyway.
So rather than read the balance of your bio, you have a rather interesting history here locally, up to including media exposure. So with that, let me kick it over to Rich. And Rich, help us get to know Dr. Salata.
Thanks, Greg. Welcome, Liz. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen.
Well, I think that maybe if you could just give us a resume of your background and how you got here and why you went into medicine, you know, in the first place. Was there any special impetus that I know that my parents, being children of the Depression, my father once said to me, "Go into medicine; you'll never be without a job."
Well, there's some truth in that. I hope. I hope we can still be sustainable with the way things are going. But I do think there's truth in that, actually. So, and my story is pretty similar. I was blessed enough to have a very influential person in my life. It was my stepfather, and when I was, from the day I can remember, his father actually was a missionary and was a physician in Los Angeles and then went over to South Africa to do missionary work and took my stepfather with him as a young boy. And then my life, he got involved in my life when I was about four, and he always said to me, do something that you can help humanity and not depend on anybody. And so medicine to him represented that. And I was blessed enough to be able to have the aptitude, and school came fairly easily to me, and I really loved science, so it all sort of fit together. And along the way in high school, I was a candy striper, and when I went to UCSD, University of California, San Diego, I worked in the student health clinic, and then I volunteered in the emergency department. And so all along the way, I reinforced what I thought I was called to do, which was to somehow, in some way, be a part of medicine and helping people. And making the world a better place by my contributions. So I, interestingly, applied to school when I was still really young and really inexperienced, and I applied all over the country and didn't get in, which was in some way a blessing because I ended up at North Carolina getting a public health degree in clinical nutrition, which I use every day to this day, and I think it's partly what sparked my interest in integrative medicine and gave me a bigger, broader perspective of medicine as a whole, because I dealt with populations before I ever went off to medical school, and then learned about individual health from there when I went to Wake Forest University. And I was blessed enough to have the kind of education that was a non-traditional education, in that we didn't sit in a lecture hall and listen to people teach us. We were involved from day one with patient cases And there was only two or three places in the country at the time that were doing this curriculum called a problem-based curriculum, which you sit around a group of six other people and you teach each other and you examine patients and you go to the microbiology lab or the anatomy lab and learn physiology and anatomy and everything all in the context of a patient case. So, for example, someone comes in with chest pain and you learn everything you need to know about figuring out what's wrong with a person based on the way the experience you have to educate yourself. So it's the way we still learn today. So when patients come in and I'm not certain what is going on with them, I go back to the basics and do a history and a physical and think about my anatomy and my physiology in order to come up with a broad differential diagnosis to figure out what's wrong with them, which is why I ended up going into internal medicine, because it's a deep specialty, but it's broad. We don't take care of babies. We don't do much with surgery. We don't take care of joints or bones in terms of fixing joints or bones like, say, a family practice doctor would. But we deal with chronic disease mostly with adults, people from, you know, age 15 to my oldest patient is 106. So, and I really enjoy the breadth of not doing the same thing every day, and the skills that are needed to kind of be a diagnostician. I think internal medicine is designed to be diagnostically, you know, inclined, and then whatever treatment plan you come up with, or whether I send them off to Dr. Jess for his specialty, or another specialist. So. You know, that's sort of what prompted me to do medicine, and as it's changing, my desires are changing also to try to meet not only the needs of the people I take care of, but to fulfill my heart, which is to take the best care of people I can. So that's where integrative medicine comes in, I think. What's your experience been like, Dr. Just?
Well, my experience has been very interesting, too. I think I was interested in medicine for the same reason that it sounds like you were. Mm-hmm. I found it to be a perfect synergy between my interest in humanitarianism on the one hand, mm-hmm. and doing something to help people,
right.
and my interest in the scientific aspects of mm-hmm. Medicine, mm-hmm. which have always interested me and led me to continue those efforts in research in the research arena, which mm-hmm. I'm sure we'll cover in a few minutes. And so it sort of reminds me when we're both agreeing on a general conjunction of science and humanitarianism,
mm-hmm.
That I just finished reading Isaacson's book on Steve Jobs.
Mm.
And apparently he was a perfect a person for that intersection, you know,
mm-hmm.
to apply methods from each area,
yeah.
and be so creative and
yeah.
innovative and
yeah.
productive a
mm-hmm.
person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that I would put myself in his category, but
you underestimate yourself, Dr. Just.
thank you. And
well, you
too.
Do amazing work, so it's true.
Thanks. And along the way, in your journey,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure one of the major I wouldn't call it a cataclysm,
mm-hmm.
but major disruptions,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes disruptions are for the good,
uh-huh.
and sometimes they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And that what I'm referring to is the advent of the hospitalist system.
Yes.
So in my practice, for a specialist,
mm-hmm.
It probably has prolonged my practice life by mm-hmm. 5 years.
Mm-hmm. The fact that they're in place now and being able to help us, right?
Right.
The fact that we have them available, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And taking a call every night 24
mm-hmm.
hours, 24/7
mm-hmm.
Gets old very quickly. I mean,
yeah.
it can make an old person out of you.
Well, you know, interestingly, when I trained in Hershey, and this was back in Pennsylvania in the 90s, you know, this was about the time that in New York they were finding that sleep deprivation is actually bad for being able to function mentally. And there were several cases of people actually dying and from poor care due to sleep deprivation. And so I was one of these innovative programs where at 10 o'clock at night we checked out and we signed out to the night crew and then came back at 6 in the morning. So for the majority of my training, I was able to at least get, you know, 6 or 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep and not have a pager and not be disturbed. And then, you know, I would come back refreshed and able to handle the day, and the night crew could handle the night. And when I did the night tour, you know, it was really busy, but then you knew that you could at least catch up during the day. So, you know, when I came into practice in 1996 here in Escondido, I was able to endure it initially, and then in 98 I had my first baby, and then I had another one 3 years later and another one 3 years later. And I will tell you, as a mother, being up every night for 10 years, and then throwing call into that and weekends into that, you get fairly spent fairly quickly. So I made a decision probably 5 or 6 years ago that I couldn't handle that anymore, and I just was too pulled to be everywhere. And I thought, you know, I'm not giving anybody good care, and it's so disruptive with my day schedule with patients and the way we have to see patients. We don't have the luxury. We're not Marcus Welby MD anymore, right? We can't just take a little doctor bag and go house to house and go into the hospital and spend an hour in the office and then go back to the hospital. We don't have the luxury of that anymore because we have to make a living and pay our staff and keep our doors open. So in order to do that, you have to have a certain volume of patients. And I didn't feel that I was doing a good job either in the hospital because I was rushing through my morning rounds or at work because I was rushing through that to get to the hospital. And so I felt out of fairness to my patients that it made the most sense for my practice to be able to be there in my office 8 to 5 and 100% attentive to what I'm doing. And the hospital people are 100% attentive to what they're doing. And then we communicate and collaborate and coordinate via, thank goodness for a medical record that we can access from anywhere in the world. So I can log on every day and find out what's going on with my patients, call my patients and say, hey, your tests look great. Looks like you're going home today. All your labs look great. Often before the hospitalists have ever had a chance to go see the patient. So I feel like people are actually getting better care these days than we used to be able to provide for them in the old-fashioned days when we did everything. And I think, you know, I think patient care-wise, it's a much better system. And I think physician we're supposed to be role models for people and we're supposed to balance our lives. And I think it's one of the many examples I think we're all trying to do to provide balance in our lives and be able to sustain our callings, you know. So that's how I feel about the hospital movement. I think it's good for everybody, actually.
Great. So, yeah, I agree. As I said, I think it's been a blessing for myself and for my group.
Yeah.
And we're able to function a heck of a lot better than in the past.
And do a better job. And people, I think, in the end, get better care because we're not half there. We're not deluded and distracted like we used to be when we were running on full steam, you know, in the red zone. So I really think it's better for everybody all the way around.
That sort of triggered a thought, an experience that I had years ago when I was chief resident up in Los Angeles at UCLA and Wadsworth VA, we had visiting professors, you know, all the time.
Right.
And on one occasion, the visiting professor was one of the giants in internal medicine, Eugene Stead from Duke. And we were making rounds, and most of us were exhausted, you know, because everybody had been up all night.
Yes.
And he's quizzing the interns, and the interns are, you know, just exhausted. You know, and so finally we asked him, you know, what's the rationale behind staying up all night and taking care of patients and getting no sleep, you know? And he said, well, that's the only way that you can see a patient take care of a patient from the beginning to the end of their acute episode. So that's the way he rationalized it.
Right.
It was the only lucid rational idea that I had ever heard, you know.
Yes.
And
yes.
I said, well, I can understand that, but, you know, I think it's counterproductive, you know, I mean, because we're not doing a good job, you know, that's
well,
true.
Well, you know, interestingly, research has shown differently now, because now that they've actually done the studies and, you know, done the appropriate, we have the appropriate information now to know that, that after a certain time, your brain actually shuts off. So I think we now know that, you know, despite the fact that egos might be in the way, I think in the long run we're human beings and we're not machines, and we're just as vulnerable to, you know, sleep deprivation and being spent as anybody else. So just because we've been blessed with our callings and we're capable of doing it doesn't make it the right thing to do. So, you know, and research is helpful for showing us all of that. So it's been interesting to kind of be part of both sides, I think, for me.
Right.
But
very well put.
It's been a good experience, and you know, I do believe that some sort of hospital work has been helpful, because I think had I come out from training and not having had any experience in the hospital, it would have been harder to do the outpatient side of things. So I do think it's probably helpful for everybody to at least do a couple years of some sort of hospital work early on, because
right.
I do think you have a much better appreciation for what you're dealing with on an outpatient setting. And vice versa, I do think hospitalists should probably have some experience with an outpatient setting for a little while before they embark on strictly a hospital rotation, because I think we have the perspective of both sides, and you lose that, I think, if we don't keep that in mind, and then we can't help each other to coordinate care. I think we need to definitely see what each of us is dealing with in order to do the best job for the patients we take care of. So, you know, and that's where you had asked me earlier to maybe try and talk a little bit about the investigation review board. And when I was in doing hospital work, part of it was
investigation. Exactly what I was going to segue to.
Right. And so I think that lent itself also, because we were involved in the hospital and doing the research in the hospital. And then we could see it, the impact of it on as an outpatient, and how we actually could use it clinically in our outpatient practices, because we started with it in an inpatient setting. So, it seemed to make sense that way in terms of us learning the bigger picture. So
well,
I think the research is really important.
Having brought up the issue of research and the Investigation Review Committee, that's a topic close to my heart, because I've been chairman of our Investigation Review Committee for 25 years straight.
Yes, amazing. It's wonderful.
But the burden of regulatory issues that's fallen onto the Investigation Review Committee is enormous, and much more so than when I first went on the job, so to speak.
Yeah.
And you have a particularly cogent and beautiful story, hopefully, to tell.
We'll have to see how it
that deals with research and the Investigation Review Committee. So why don't I turn it over to you, and you can describe that story.
Yeah, it's actually a very sweet story. It's about, has to do with my son, who's now 14. And interestingly, when I was in college as just a baby student at UCSD, one of the very first things I did back in the early 80s was do research on monoclonal antibodies, which for those of you who that sounds like a big, long word, it's basically a protein structure that we can use to target things either at a cellular level, where we can help either map out ways nerves grow, or there's lots of uses now for this particular kind of technology. But the essence of it is that I worked on this in college as my research that I did all through my years at UCSD in a biology lab. And it was amazing technology that we're using today to target tumors and cancer cells, and just the use of it today has been amazing. But the interesting part for me was that when I came to be a mother, I was pregnant with my first child, and I was out shopping, and somebody approached me from the American Cancer Society and wanted to get my baby's cord blood, the placental cord blood from when you have your baby. The placenta comes out and you get blood from that, and then you can do all kinds of stem cell things and amazing things with that basic very primitive blood that comes from the newborn baby. And so I didn't really know much about it other than the science behind it. And so the Red Cross needed it, and I said, well, sure, you know, I'm happy to donate to you. It's a good cause. It doesn't hurt me in any way. It doesn't hurt my baby. It's things that we would normally throw in the garbage, and it's sort of like liquid gold now that we're using for amazing treatment programs for people. So I was very inclined to contribute to that, and then, interestingly, Dr. Justin and I were, you know, you recall that we were involved in the investigational review board at Palomar Medical Center, and Dr. Jerry Collins was fortunate enough to get a research grant to do cord blood research, and about this time, I was pregnant with number two, and I thought long and hard about what to do with that cord blood, and at that point, I started to realize the value in what I had with these, with being pregnant and having these children, and so I opted to bank my child's cord blood, my second child, at the University of Arizona, and then the third child I went on to bank also, and, you know, meanwhile, we're doing this amazing research at Palomar Medical Center with the cord blood. So the interesting part of the story for me is that when my oldest child, whose blood I gave to the Red Cross, whose cord blood I gave to the Red Cross, he ended up having an eye injury where the back of his eye got damaged by a bungee cord, and the back of his retina is smashed. Well, I keep getting my cord blood for my two other children is banked at the University of Arizona, and they keep sending me informational bulletins about what research they're doing now with this cord blood. Well, amazingly to me, they're doing research on retinal transplants. And my son, who's now 14, wanted to always fly F-18 jets because we live in San Diego where Miramar Air Force and the Blue Angels fly, and we go every year. We've faithfully gone every year to the Blue Angels Air Show, and my son was devastated when he learned he would probably never fly a F-18 fighter jet because of his eye injury. Well, he's now decided that he's going to design F-18s, and he wants to be an aeronautical engineer and make them fly better, stronger, and faster. And he's got the aptitude and the mind to do it. And the ironic thing for me, and that has yet to be determined for him in his lifetime, is I recently took him to a retinal specialist in town who's with one of the big hospital systems in our city. And I said, you know, do you think in his lifetime we'll ever be able to do retinal transplants? And he said, well, interestingly, they're doing it from cord blood. He said the missing factor is we need a way to get the nerves to grow from the back of the eye, which is the retina, to the part of the brain where we see, where our vision is processed. So I shared with him the fact that I did research in college at UCSD on the monoclonal antibodies and tracked the visual pathway. And he said, well, that's the missing piece, and I'm sure in his lifetime we'll be able to grow that pathway in humans. And I just burst into tears because for me it was such an amazing, touching story. And I went on to write a little short story that I have yet to do anything with, but it's sitting on my computer at home because his brother's cord blood's banked. And so I thought, boy, wouldn't it be amazing if at some point in these children's lifetime, because he and his brother, it's sort of like Cain and Abel. They love each other, but there's this rift from his brother who was three with this bungee cord. And it just breaks my heart because they basically get along, but there's times when they really are at each other's throats. Not literally, right. But you know what I mean. Sibling rivalry, it's typical. Right. So I wrote the story fast-forwarding to, you know, 10 or 20 years from now, sitting around the table at Thanksgiving where my middle son's doing research and figures out a way to get his brother a retinal transplant using his own cord blood. Well, the way the story ends is that my son flies his brother in an F-18 that he then designs. So I just thought it was a precious story. And, you know, the boys are forever mended by the use of this technology that was amazing enough for their mother to have worked on as a little baby student at UCSD at 17 years old. So I just thought, who knows what will come of it? Who knows what in his lifetime? But, man, isn't medicine and science and life so amazing that, you know, this is how life goes full circle and you never really know what tomorrow's going to bring. But I can only hope that in his lifetime he gets his retinal transplant and he and his brother's cord blood gets used for his vision and they're mended. So, and then he flies his F-18 that he designed. So wouldn't that be just sweet? So I don't know. You know, that's just my amazing little story about the journey that I've experienced in medicine and research and childbearing and, you know, kind of brings it all together full circle, which is the name of the story. So,
right. That's the name of the story.
Yeah, it's the name of the story, Full Circle. So fantastic. We'll see. I'll let you know.
When I first heard it, I said I was ready to go out and buy the book. I thought you published it. You know?
No,
but
I need to.
Then you said, well, the book's in my top desk drawer. You know,
yeah,
or something like
they
that.
Need to make a movie. Right? It's a true story.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, it'd be a great movie.
I know that we don't have a lot of time left, but maybe we can start touching on the topic of integrative medicine.
Yes.
Which you alluded to.
Yes.
And your nutritional background stimulated further interest in that area.
Yeah.
And as you know, we're starting an integrative oncology program in our offices.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you could maybe give us some pearls of wisdom on that score.
Well, I'm not sure I can give you pearls, but I can give you my thoughts about how I've found it to be really helpful for my practice because, you know, I think modern Western medicine can only take us so far, and we do amazing things, and we're learning more every day and being able to do more amazing things every day. But, you know, life is such that we're not just machines that we fix, and we're people with minds and bodies and spirits. And I think when you neglect to look at the person as a whole, you miss a lot because so much of our health is impacted by the way we think, our upbringings, our experiences on a daily basis, our relationships with people, our use of supplements, our use of things like acupuncture and chiropractic care. And I think being closed-minded with healthcare these days is sort of doing a disservice to our patients because if we're in this business to help them, then we need to be open-minded. And, you know, one of the things we take in our oath is to do no harm. Well, my perspective is that if it's going to help you, great. If it's going to harm you, I will let you know that. But there's so many amazing things out there with acupuncture and nutritional supplementation and, you know, antioxidants and relaxation techniques and meditation. And we're finding out so much more about how the body works than just biochemistry, physiology, and anatomy that we've got to not lose sight. And, you know, our spiritual part of it is part of it, our spiritual well-being, you know, our emotional well-being, our physical well-being. And so we need to not lose sight of the fact that that's all connected. You know, our bodies are so amazing that if one of those areas is not in balance, then we're going to have a health consequence. And so when we treat people, you know, I spend a lot of time kind of getting to know them so that I know how their mind thinks and I know where their faith is based and I know what they think is helpful for them because I really think it's important to treat people as a whole rather than just write a prescription and say, here's your Lipitor and go get a stent. You know, I think there's way more to the story than because there's reasons that people don't take care of themselves. There's reasons that are very deep psychologically sometimes, and there's reasons that people can't get better because maybe their resources are limited or maybe, you know, they can't take a medication because their body won't tolerate it. So we have to think outside the box and treat them with whole foods, for example. So I just have really come to believe in my years of practice that, you know, we're in this to help people to the best ability we can. And if we're short-sighted and closed-minded and don't have an open mind about the world of options out there, I alluded to you earlier about a patient of mine who had pancreas cancer who went to get heat treatment. You know, who would have thought that heat treatment is helpful, but apparently it suppressed the growth of her cancer for a while, and she bought some time, which was amazing for her because then she could have a better quality of life and, you know, take care of things and have more time to do that. So I just feel like if it's not going to hurt, you know, our jobs as physicians, I think, are to educate people about the things that aren't good for them. But we also need to be open-minded about things they bring to us to educate us about what could be good for them. So it's like with vitamins, you know, the whole vitamin D story, that's a whole other half-hour discussion that you and I could have. But, you know, in my time since I started, you know, and I have a nutrition background, so this vitamin D story has been evolving, and now it's like hot off the press, an amazing thing we haven't really even begin to touch. So I just think we need to stand poised and be open-minded and learn from each other and grow together as a world so that we can take the best care of people possible. And there's lots of amazing things out there that we can share, And integrative medicine is a way to do that because we all come together to take the best care of people possible. So I think it just remains to be seen what the future holds for all of us, which will
right.
hopefully be the best we can do.
Right,
so,
yeah, absolutely.
Exciting.
Well,
exciting.
You put it better than I could ever phrase it.
Oh, bless you. Thank you. I live it.
Right. We have to continue this conversation at another time. That
Definitely.
Would be terrific.
Definitely.
Well, there you have it, Dr. Elizabeth Salata, a dynamo. Check her out.
Thank you, Greg.
On the web. Elizabeth, SALADAND.com. You will not regret it. Well,
thank you so much.
It's been
Greg.
Another edition of This Week in Oncology. Join us next week when we'll chat with, I can't remember our guest next week, but join us anyway. Thanks again, everybody.
It's Jerry Collins again.
Jerry Collins.
Great. He's wonderful.
All right. So that's our live portion of the show. And if you are able to stick around for just a few more minutes, we can kibitz or just wind it down completely.
I'd be happy to stick on the line for you and chit-chat some more. That'd be lovely.
Okay.
Great. along the integrative medicine / oncology line, there's one of the big impediments is the lack of reimbursement.
Mm-hmm.
Yet it's always amazed me that when you bring up the subject, recently it's sort of lessened a little bit, but I've been impressed over the years that maybe half of the patients that I talk about nutrition, the diet, you know, blah, 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 acupuncture, whatever, that turns off about half of the patients.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they say, you really believe in that? You know, I mean,
I think it is? I think it's just naivete, and they don't really understand, number one, what it is, and number two, how it's supposed to work. So, you know, I think I'm in a kind of a good position because I've had it all done. Like, I've had acupuncture, you know, I've taken herbs, I've done some alternative medicine for myself to get my, like, I had a pinched nerve in my neck and I had to get acupuncture and go to the chiropractor. I didn't want to do it.
Right.
I was very reluctant and hesitant because it was an unknown and I was very traditional at the time. But, you know, when I had that experience, it was like, wow, this is, like,
right.
incredible. I was a total believer, but I had to experience it. So I think those of us that are in integrative medicine, if we haven't had the experiences for ourselves, I think it's incredibly important to have a treatment of acupuncture, get some chiropractic right. care, so you know exactly what you're dealing with. Because I not only speak from experience, you know, I can speak clinically, but I can also right. speak from personal experience, which I think is way more powerful. Because when you've done it yourself, it's like us having colonoscopies, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We've
right.
had them. We can tell
right.
them how it is. So
right.
it's the same with integrative medicine practices. You know, you need to have the experience of what's involved so that you can reassure people that, yeah, there is a role to play for this. And
that's a great point because what we've all of the practitioners, you know, that we have on tap for our
mm-hmm.
program
mm-hmm.
have offered to treat the staff.
Well, they
you
need
know,
to
the
be therapy- treated. They need to
right.
they need to get that. They need to, because explaining it and understanding it in your head is way different than experiencing it.
Right.
And I think it's really important to have that experience so that you can share that with people.
Yeah.
So.
I've had acupuncture myself,
mm-hmm.
and Dee Dee's had acupuncture,
mm-hmm.
my wife.
Have you guys
and,
done chiropractic treatments? Have you done chiropractic care?
She has. I
uh-huh.
haven't.
Uh-huh.
I've been there when she's had the treatments, you know, and
right.
so forth. And a lot of it is there are multiple modalities used.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
right.
not as if you're getting your spine cracked, you know, or
right.
something, you know,
right.
Quote unquote.
But that's why it's worth people having the experience, because, you know, between physical
right.
therapy and, you know, electronic stimulation or electric stimulation and the heat packs, and there's all that stuff that's involved in rehabilitation of, say, an injury that, you know, if you haven't had the experience, I mean, I've had physical therapy, I've had it all because I've had injuries and stuff, and it's all effective, but certain things are more effective for certain types of complaints, you know, and I can definitely tell you where what's going to work. And it's not only diagnostic sometimes with acupuncture, but it's therapeutic because I've used it to target nerves and then had somebody go on and get a facet block of the nerve that I had acupuncture isolate because it's that specific. And so, you know, you can definitely use it all together to get the best outcome for people. But you've got to have experienced it so you know what to use for what. I think it's really helpful.
Yeah, so. we've adopted the attitude that integrative oncology is a three-prong stool involving nutrition, exercise, and stress management.
Yeah.
And that's basically what we address.
That's good.
And then people, I can relate to that, you know, that makes sense, you know.
Of course. That's basic enough. That's a good start anyway.
Right.
It's a good place to start.
Right.
So. All right, dear. Well, I'm going to get back to work because I have people to see. So thank you so much for this opportunity to sit and chit-chat with you. It was great.
Well, thank you very much.
Absolutely.
And we'll do it again.
Yes, let me know.
Okay.
Yeah, just give me a couple weeks' notice so I can rearrange my schedule. So that'd be great.
Right.
Okay.
Good.
All right. Take care. Thank you again, gentlemen.
Thank you, Dr. Salata.
Absolutely.
Well, there you have it. There you have it. One time. This will be the final close on our session today with Dr. Elizabeth Salata. That's ElizabethSalataMD.com. Check it out. Well, that was fascinating, Rich. I mean, I could think of no better way to really advocate for a much broader worldview inside of medicine than some of the traditionalist thinking. So that kind of packed it all in about a 35-minute session.
Yeah, that was really, really excellent.
Yeah. All right. Well, we will proceed next week with Dr. Jerry Collins from right here in Escondido of Palomar Health. He's also chief of medical quality for the institution. So he's going to have an interesting perspective, not just on the pathology side of things, but the overall quality management perspective for a large health system. So join us next week for another episode of This Week in Oncology. For Rich Just, this is Greg Masters saying bye now.
Bye-bye. That was winner.